Well, good morning. We are going to continue the book of Esther now. The last time we looked at the historical context of it, some of the evidence for the historical reliability of the book, and we also looked at chapters 1 and 2. Now, briefly, I want to review just a couple of things in case you were gone and it was also a while ago. But I want people to understand how this book is often interpreted. Not that I'm teaching it this way, but here's a section from a Bible encyclopedia that it says, Esther as a person, whether historical, semi-historical, or fictional, has played an important role in traditional Judaism and has been the focus of many of today's feminist exegetes. Some modern interpreters have criticized Esther for not acting sooner or more forcefully than she did, especially when compared to another Jewish heroine, Judith. So, listen to this. They don't know if it's historical, if it's a little bit, if it's completely fictional. They talk about Esther as a framework for feminism. So these are some of the common ways that the book is being interpreted. We also have sort of a holy, pietistic type of reading of Esther too, where people read things into the text that she was this perfect example of a follower of God as well as Mordecai. We're going to talk about that more in our final segment, but today we're going to continue working through the book. So chapter 2 is when Esther becomes the queen. So in verse 16, it says, Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So if we look at the chronology of this book and compare that to Xerxes or Ahasuerus and some of the ancient world history, we see that the book opens up in chapter 1 in his 3rd year. He's about 35 years old at that time. In the next year, after this banquet, is when he is in Greece, trying to conquer Greece, but the Persians lose at the Battle of Salamis. He retreats back to Persia. And the book of Esther picks up again in chapter 2 in the 7th year of his reign. And in 2:16, we see that's when she eventually becomes queen. Then, when we're going to get into chapter 3, we have now moved forward about 5 more years. Esther 3:7 tells us the 12th year of his reign. And then there's not another chronological marker after that, but maybe there's another year that completes through all of the things that happened. Certainly there's a bit of a time span. We don't know what happened to Esther after that. We know what happened to Xerxes, though. Eventually, in the 21st year of his reign, he was assassinated by the commander of the royal bodyguard. And then throughout all sorts of palace intrigues, one of his sons, Artaxerxes I, ended up becoming the king. And he's the king that we see in Nehemiah. So let's then get to chapter 3. Chapter 3 begins. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Now, if you remember from the end of chapter 2, Mordecai actually saved the king's life in a way. He found out about a plot, and then he informed Esther, and Esther told the king. But the king never really understood who was responsible for saving him with this information. And so he didn't do anything about it. He knew who Mordecai was because Mordecai was in his service, one of his servants, one of his officials, but he didn't really realize, okay, Mordecai saved my life. So the beginning of chapter 1, we actually see the promotion of Haman. He comes into the story and he is one of the main antagonists in the book of Esther. We see his plot. We'll read about that soon. But here it tells us something. He is the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. And then we see at the king's gate, people are bowing down and paying homage to him. So three things actually about that. Historically, first of all, here's the king's gate. It was a real place. It's been excavated. We know the person was not just, the author of Esther was not just making up something that sounded royal and palace-y. It was actually called the king's gate there, and it has inscriptions of the king on it. In fact, King Xerxes here, or Ahasuerus, the same guy. But then we see something else. We see this Agagite mentioned. And some interpreters have looked at that and they have said, this sort of seems like Agag, who the Amalekite, who Saul was supposed to kill and failed to do so, and the Amalekites lived on. Now, I suppose that's possible, and it's an interesting link, yet there's also a place in the ancient Persian Empire, the land of the Medes specifically, a place called Agag, and more than likely this is the location that he was from. So it's just giving us some historical information about him. It's not saying that he is the descendant of one of these enemies of the kings of Israel. But then we see the bowing down here. And this leads to some strife between Mordecai and Haman. Because in verse 3 it says, the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him, he would not listen to them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. So he said, I'm not bowing down to Haman because I'm a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. So this triggers Haman, and he goes into a psychopathic rage. If we continue reading the story, it was not just, I don't like this Mordecai guy. Look at verse 6. He disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So he is not content with just holding a grudge against Mordecai, or even trying to punish Mordecai, which he probably could have because it was against the king's command. But he decides he's going to destroy all of Mordecai's people. Now, we don't really know what's going on in the background here, in the spiritual background, because the author doesn't say anything about this. But certainly we could think that there is some satanic, demonic plot going back here. And in fact, there is a demon called the Prince of Persia that's mentioned in the book of Daniel. And he also talks about the Prince of Greece. So it seems like there were these demons who were over certain areas of the world or certain nations. And they influenced the kings and some of the other high officials to steer them towards what Satan's agenda was. And this, of course, would certainly fit with that. So reading into the text a little bit, but informed from other scripture, certainly it seems odd that Haman would have reacted so intensely to one guy simply not bowing down to him. But the other question that comes up is whether or not Mordecai actually should have bowed down, or if there is an issue here. So if we look at the Hebrew words of this verse, we have bow down and show of respect, but we don't have worship. So let's go over to Daniel 3:5 just quickly, because this is another passage that I think informs us a little bit here. So this is when Nebuchadnezzar has built the golden image. And he says in verse 5, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. So even in English, we see the difference here, but they're completely different Hebrew words. So this was not worshiping here in the book of Esther. It was just more like a traditional bow, show of respect. And in fact, we see in other instances, Israelites doing this. We can just look at one passage, 1 Samuel 24:8, which says, "Now afterward, David arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, 'My lord the king.' And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself." Now, of course, David is not worshiping Saul like he's some deity. And in fact, that would have been off limits in the Persian Empire either. Haman could not have asked people to bow down and worship towards him. The king would have executed him for that. So this is more like Mordecai doesn't like Haman, and that leads to Haman wanting to kill Mordecai and all his people. And it's understandable, too, that there would be some strife between these two officials. They're probably vying for a position, trying to get promoted. And then Mordecai saves the king's life, but he sees Haman gets promoted and he gets no credit. And so he's upset at Haman and think, why should I bow down to this guy? I should have been the one that got promoted. Well, of course, the circumstances lead to something very dire. Now in verse 7, we see the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day, from month to month, until the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. So a couple of brief things about this. All right, so first of all, the month of Nisan. So we know when in the year this is. It's the spring. Passover is actually going to be coming up quite soon. But what is this, the Pur or the lots? So the festival that came out of the book of Esther is Purim, the festival of lots. And of course, it's celebrating deliverance of the people from the destruction that Haman instigated. But what are these things? You might think of them a little bit like dice. And there were different ways that they made them in the ancient world. But one really common way was to use these little pieces of bones called astragali. And then they could mark on each side of them. Or you could carve a rock or something like that. And then you'd cast it. And they would put numbers or letters or different symbols on it. And it was used in divination. So they were trying to figure out what the gods were telling them. But we also see that the ancient Israelites used lots quite a few times, sometimes correctly, sometimes incorrectly. But if we go to the book of Proverbs, there's a good explanation for the difference between lots being cast when God tells the Israelites to do it, and lots being cast by pagans who are trying to find out what Marduk or Ishtar or somebody wants them to do. Proverbs 16:33 says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." So when God was telling them to use this, he was guiding it. He was using it basically as a way to communicate to them without speaking directly to them. So of course the prophets would get direct words from God, but other times God would give messages through other means, and this is one of the ways. Even the last disciple of Jesus, the replacement for Judas, remember? That was also casting lots in it. That's the final time that we actually see it used. So there were, just like other modes of worship, there were ways that were right and were connected to God's commands, and there were ways that were wrong and that were connected to polytheism or pagan theology. So here, of course, Haman is trying to get the will of probably Ahura Mazda. That was the god of the Persians. They were mostly monotheistic by this point in the reign of Ahasuerus. But, you know, they had, of course, lots of different gods throughout the empire based on the peoples. Maybe Haman was doing it to one of his ancestral gods. We're not sure, but of course, he's just trying to get some guidance here from whoever he worships. So he casts the lot, and then he has this conversation with the king, and he tells the king, without naming the people, that there is this one people all over your provinces, all over your kingdom. They have different laws, and he says they don't observe the king's laws, so you should get rid of them. And he wants to have this decree be issued, and he sweetens the deal by saying he's going to pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasury. So he's basically bribing the king. Haman was apparently very wealthy. And so they make this law, and suddenly the Jews are in a really bad place. It's not going to happen immediately, but it is coming up soon. So this is another one of those historical points in the book of Esther, because we find out later that there's no way to revoke this edict that the king has issued, that Haman pushed him into. They had irreversible laws. And so we'll find out later, the only way to combat this was to issue a counter decree. So then we see that they send the edict out. Letters, verse 13. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. Now, two things about the timing of this edict. We see in verse 12, it says, the scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded. So the 13th day of the first month, this is the eve of Passover. So the 14th of Nisan is Passover. This is the eve of Passover, but we don't have any commentary about this important festival, most important festival there. Very, very strange. Yet you also wonder, did Haman do this on purpose? Did he wait until this day because he knew that this was the main festival for the Jews? But again, Mordecai, we don't have Mordecai or Esther saying anything. We don't have any kind of comment in the text about Passover. This is just another one of those instances where you're reading through the book of Esther and you're wondering, where is God's name? Where is prayer? Where is any of the festivals referenced? Where's the Mosaic Law? It's not there. But we see that there are connections to all that, and probably Haman did issue the edict purposefully right before Passover. It's like an extra jab at the Jews. You're about to celebrate. Well, now you just found out that we're going to try to massacre all of you later in the year. So, horrible situation, and now they don't know what to do. So Mordecai, he decides that he's going to go into the middle of the city and make a public spectacle. So Esther 4, verse 1, it says, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. So he's obviously very, very upset. He went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. Each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. So a lot of people were doing this to some extent, at least. Maybe they didn't go into the city square and do it, but they are in great mourning. They are fasting. But again, we don't see prayer mentioned. Now, I am sure that some of the Jews throughout the empire were praying about this, right? But the author here is not mentioning that, because the author's focused on what's going on in the lives of Esther and Mordecai and in Susa specifically. Let's look at a couple of examples of Mordecai here. So, he is going into the city square and he's wailing loudly. Now, we've got some places where we see the Pharisees doing something like this. If I can find my references here. Just a second. I believe we've got Matthew 6, 1 through 18. Let's just take a look at that briefly. Matthew 6, 1 says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven." And then Jesus continues on with some other specific examples. Verse 5, "When you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners so that they may be seen by men." And in verse 18, 17 and 18, "But when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face so that your fasting will not be noticed by men, but by your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." So we could probably say that Mordecai is being a little bit dramatic here. Obviously, it's understandable that he's upset, but his reaction, instead of going and praying, is to go into the middle of the city square and to make a spectacle. And it doesn't help at all either, because no one else, either they don't care, or they figure that this is a decree of the king. There's nothing that we can do about it now. So Mordecai's got to come up with a plan. And he does. He's got a plan, and Esther is an instrumental part of that plan. So we go later in chapter 4. Let's see what happens. Verse 12. "They related Esther's words to Mordecai. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther." Oh, excuse me. Let's go back to verse 11. Sorry. Esther says, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. They related Esther's words to Mordecai. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you, in the king's palace, can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." So Mordecai recognizes that Esther has a lot of influence over the king. The king picked her from all these different women to be the queen. He obviously likes her. Now, it doesn't mean that he's going to listen to everything that she says, but this is their best bet. So he tells Mordecai, "You need to go talk to the king and beg him not to do this, or to resolve this so that the Jews won't be killed all over the empire." But Esther's initial reaction is to give an excuse that, she can't go into the king in his throne room because there's this law that if you're not summoned, then you can be put to death unless the king holds out the golden scepter. I don't think this is a very plausible excuse for Esther at this point, because look at the behavior of Xerxes or Ahasuerus. Way back at the beginning of the book, Vashti is commanded by her husband, the king, to come out and display herself, right? And she just refuses to do it. And what does he do? He doesn't really punish her. He doesn't kill her. He doesn't torture her. He just says, "You're not my main queen anymore. You're off to the side now." And then she just lives in the queen's apartments after that. And he picks a new queen. He really likes Esther, and he's not going to just execute her for coming into the throne room to wait to see if she'll be allowed to come talk to him. So she's a little apprehensive about that. Again, we can only speculate on why that is. Maybe she's just very fearful. Maybe she thinks that she doesn't want to risk her position by telling the king who she is, that she's a Jew. Maybe she thinks that somebody else will take care of it. But then Mordecai has a very interesting reply to her here. He says, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews." All right. Well, if we just read that verse, we might think he's saying, look, all the Jews are going to get killed in this edict. You're going to get killed too. Although the way that it's actually written, it's doubtful that people would have been breaking into the palace to try to kill her. But we might think that. But then he says in verse 14, "If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish." So he said, he threatens her, really, because all the other Jews will be fine, but you're going to die, and your father's house is going to be wiped out. So he's almost seems to be threatening assassination on Esther, a death threat. You have to do this, or you're going to die. Everybody else will be fine somehow, but you're going to pay for it. And then he adds in, of course, "Who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" Of course, she's got this position. She might as well use it. But also notice that he doesn't say anything about God here. Relief and deliverance from another place, whatever that means. This deliverance here, this is not the usual word for salvation there, you know, spiritual salvation that we get there. So he sees, or he thinks that something is going to deliver them, but he doesn't specify anything about God. Again, just displaying the secular mindset of Mordecai and Esther at this point. So this convinces Esther. She thinks, all right, yeah, I'm not going to take that risk. So she gets to this point where she can choose between three choices. She could be killed by Haman, or actually just whoever's there in Susa that decides they're going to attack the Jews. But, you know, Haman might be the one that would go after her. She could be destroyed by whatever Mordecai is implying, whether that's Mordecai himself or he thinks that she's just going to get some kind of justice because she didn't help out her people. Or she could go before the king and face whatever consequences. And so she picks really the easiest option of the three because she knows that the king's not going to execute her for that. So she goes in to see the king in chapter 5. And her way to do this is by planning a banquet. It says, "On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes, stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms, and the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. When the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight, and the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. The king said to her, 'What is troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be given to you.'" This does not at all sound like a situation in which she should have been afraid to stand before the king. Instead, he brings her in, "I'll give you half the kingdom." And so she says, "I'm going to do a banquet for you and Haman," because she knows that Haman is the architect of destruction here. So she's got to somehow let the king know he's the bad guy, get rid of him and save us. And whatever the plan was in her head originally, I don't know. But we'll see how it unfolds, which I think is a sign of divine intervention here. So she sets up this banquet. And in verse 9, we have some key information about Haman here. It says, "Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons in every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and the servants of the king. Haman also said, "Even Esther the queen, let no one but me come in with the king to the banquet which she had prepared." So he's telling about how awesome he is to everybody. He's really happy. Yeah, somebody recognized me finally. Look, I'm third in the kingdom because Esther is inviting just me and the king. And look at all my money. Look at all my sons. Look at how much the king is honoring me. So we see quite a bit of pride here in Haman. And we see this multiple places in the book. Back in chapter 3, here in 5, chapter 6, chapter 7. And then eventually we'll see what happens to him. But there are, of course, many passages throughout Scripture that explain this problem and even relate directly to the type of situation that Haman got himself into. So if we go to Proverbs. I put the wrong verse there. Oh, it didn't. Okay, Proverbs 8:13. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogance and the evil way and the perverted mouth I hate. Proverbs 11:2. When pride comes, then comes dishonor, but with the humble is wisdom. And then finally, 16, verse 18. Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before stumbling. And this is exactly what is going to happen to Haman. We see Isaiah says something similarly. Matthew 12. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled. Whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. We're going to see destruction and humbling as the result of Haman's pride. And then Paul as well warns in 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5 about pride. He specifies in verse 2, boastful, arrogant there. And then he also talks about in 1 Timothy how pride or conceit was the original sin of Satan as well. So Haman, not knowing or not paying attention to these guidelines, gets himself into so much trouble, it leads ultimately to his destruction. So back to chapter 5. So he talks about how awesome he is, and then he gets some advice from his wife, because even though he's so great, he says in verse 13, all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. So he can't get over this, that one person is not bowing down to him and displaying how great Haman is. And it's just eating away at him. And so his wife and his friends give him some advice in verse 14. Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, so about 75 feet high. And in the morning, ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it, and then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. So these gallows, basically, it's like a stake that they would impale someone on. So he wanted to impale Mordecai on this stake 75 feet in the air so that everybody could see this guy that didn't honor Haman. He's dead now, and he is an example that you don't mess with Haman. But God intervenes here. Now, the book doesn't say this, but if we read and we realize that God exists and God's hand is in history, in chapter 6, verse 1, it says, during that night, the king could not sleep. So he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. By the way, these chronicles of the kings of Persia are also known from ancient historical sources. So he starts reading. He hopes he can fall asleep, maybe, or at least decides I might as well spend my time doing something productive. And in verse 2, it says that Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So this is the first that he knows any of these details. Verse 3, the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." So he finds out Mordecai saved his life, but nothing's been done for him. And he decides, oh, we've got to rectify this situation. And so he's going to honor Mordecai. But it's very ironic because in verse 5 it says, the king's servant said to him, "Behold, Haman is standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." And Haman comes in and they talk. And Haman thinks, "Who would the king desire to honor more than me?" And so he thinks this is actually going to be honoring him. And so he tells the king, "Oh, yeah, you should do the best stuff for this guy. A royal robe that the king wore, the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And then have him be on horseback through the entire city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" So Haman thinks, "Oh yeah, this is going to be me." Of course he does. He's a narcissist. So he's ready to be honored once again. But what happens? The tables are completely turned here. Because the king in verse 10 says, "This is for Mordecai the Jew who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said." So not only is Mordecai going to get honored, but Haman's actually the guy who has to do it for him. So here he gets humbled, all right? So the pride, humility part here. Soon he's going to lead himself to destruction as well. But first he gets humbled. So Mordecai finally gets honored for this. The king recognized that he saved his life. And everybody realizes he's a good guy who's actually doing his job and serving the king. Now, in verse 13 of chapter 6, there's a very interesting allusion to future events. It says, "Haman recounted to Zeresh his wife and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh his wife said to him, 'If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him.'" So his wife makes this prediction. Why did she make a prediction like that? Again, we don't know exactly why, but if she knew history, then she would have many examples throughout history of when the Jews were preserved, when they were restored, when they were saved from destruction. And so she might be thinking, look at all this stuff that's happened in the past where people tried to destroy the Israelites, tried to destroy the kingdom of Judah, and they never fully succeeded. And now, you know, the Jews are back in their land. They have the temple rebuilt. Jerusalem is somewhat restored. Nehemiah hasn't rebuilt the walls yet, but people are living there again. And she thinks, maybe that God that they follow, he's actually powerful and he can do some things. Not that she believes he's the only God or that she would trust in him for salvation or something, but they're thinking more from a polytheistic mindset. So she thinks, you're not going to overcome him. Maybe she doesn't think that what's going to happen will happen to him, but he's not going to succeed. So then we get into chapter 7, and this is the second banquet. So at the first banquet, Esther talks to the king, and she gets cold feet and decides, I'm not ready to tell the king. And so she waits until the next banquet. She says, "Oh, my request is come to another banquet." All right. Well, her fear, her apprehension, again, works in the plan of God, because in between her first banquet and her second banquet was this night when Ahasuerus goes and finds out Mordecai saved him and honors Mordecai. And so now he's got some favor towards Mordecai the Jew. And now, you know, Haman is not quite as high status. He's not the only guy who's been doing good things for the king. So they have the second banquet here. And again, the king says, "What's your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done." And so Esther replies and tells the situation. Verse 4 of chapter 7, "For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king." Now the king still doesn't know that she's a Jew. And so he's kind of like wondering what's going on here. So he says, "Who is he and where is he who would presume to do this?" Now, he was completely aware that Haman had asked for this edict to be issued to destroy the Jews. And so he hasn't quite connected things yet. So he's just ready to go after whoever is going to try to kill Esther and her people. And then she says, verse 6, Esther said, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. So now everything is clear in the king's mind, but he's very angry. And something else happens here that's, I think, also some divine guidance. The king gets mad and he gets up, verse 7, he goes to the palace garden. "But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king." All right, makes sense. The king's gone, so he can talk to Esther and beg her, "Come on, please, please help me while the king's out there thinking about what to do. Just tell him to spare me." But he gets himself into even more trouble by the way that he was doing it. Verse 8, "When the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, 'Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?' As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face." So Haman might have gotten off a little bit easier had he not done that. But, you know, he's lost his mind and he's begging her on his knees and he's on the couch. And the king thinks that Haman's in there trying to assault the queen already. And that's it. So now they're going to execute him. And conveniently, verse 10, they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. So Haman, he thought he was the greatest, the best ever, and no one could oppose him. Mordecai is the one guy that doesn't bow down, so he decides, let's get rid of this guy, builds the gallows. He ends up being executed on his own gallows. So there's the pride leading to destruction there. Now, the last thing I want to talk about before we stop this section, because we'll do our final section in the future with chapters 8 through 10. I just want to go over a few of the ideas here and kind of summarize the whole story so far. So everything isn't fixed yet, but Haman is dead. But we've had the initial banquet way back in chapter 1. And Vashti gets deposed because she won't do what the king wants her to do. But again, she doesn't get killed. She doesn't get tortured. She's just not the main queen anymore. So we see the character of Xerxes. He is not really bloodthirsty at all. He's a king. He's very full of himself in some ways. But even if we read some of his texts and the Greek texts about him, he's not the most violent guy. That's good to know for later on. Chapter 2, he recruits a new queen, and here we get introduced to Mordecai and Esther. But note, again, they go by their Persian names. They hide that they are Jews. No one finds out about it until this chapter. that a little bit before they found out Mordecai was a Jew, but they didn't know that Esther was until that connection was made with Haman's decree there. She marries this Gentile king, which was against the Mosaic law, and as well as breaking the dining practices, the food laws, the dietary practices. But there's no discussion of that, right? The author doesn't comment on that. In many places in the Bible, we do get that type of commentary. Or one of the prophets or someone corrects the king or the queen or whoever and says, look, you're breaking God's law. You shouldn't be doing that. But there's no commentary here. It's just presenting things as they happened. Then we get in chapter 3, Mordecai refuses to bow down. He gives this excuse, I'm a Jew, weak excuse, really. But he doesn't want to honor Haman. Kind of backfires on him initially, of course, because Haman issues this decree to kill Mordecai and all the other Jews. Then Mordecai appeals to Esther. And instead of praying, they just say, let's go do some fasting. In fact, that's what Esther says as well. She says, send a message out to the people, have them fast for 3 days, right? There's nothing about prayer. Mordecai goes into the middle of the city, wails and cries with sackcloth and ashes, fasts. He doesn't pray either. And then he gives this veiled threat to Esther, and he says that deliverance is going to come from some other place. He actually says place. He doesn't even say person. It's like he isn't even thinking about God intervening in history there. Well, he convinces her, because it's obviously not that much of a problem for her to go talk to the king. So she does that, and she gets a little bit of cold feet. She's apprehensive, but that ends up playing in her favor, because then the king finds out Mordecai saved his life. Next banquet, she finally tells the king. King gets mad, goes off in the garden. Haman's falling all over her. It's even worse for her. All right, so my point here is twofold. First, that Mordecai and Esther seem quite secular. I don't mean it in the sense that they're atheists, but they're not really living strong spiritual lives following all the commands of God, and they don't really seem to be thinking about him intervening in history or their personal lives. They're not praying to him about any of this. But what we do see through all these strange situations is that God is there in the background. And we're going to continue to see that in the last three chapters. And then we'll address some of the specific issues in that final session when I teach the book. So let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity to meet and worship you in fellowship. We thank you for your word and the instruction that it gives us, sometimes direct, sometimes indirect. We thank you for your hand in history, that you are always there guiding, even when we don't realize it, even when we are not paying attention to you. I pray that we would use this knowledge from your word to apply to our own lives and learn lessons from history in your book. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.